There's not much left of this, and there's a lot of detail you can fill in, but you had Amon follow Manasseh, and he followed in all of his apostasy. Now, we know that Manasseh actually repented, which is good for him, but just the basic pattern here is basically Hezekiah and Isaiah represent the beginning of the church in this pattern. And then Manasseh represents the process of apostasy. And Amon was killed by a conspiracy. And then we have Josiah. And he represents the Reformation because they found hidden in the temple the book of the law. And we know that up until the Reformation, the Catholic Church had made it illegal for anybody not to only own a copy, but all liturgy, all Bibles had to be in the language of Latin. But after Martin Luther posted his theses at the Church of Wittenberg, from that you can go from 1517 to about a lifetime later, and all of a sudden we've got about 25 translations of the Bible. And that is symbolic of the Reform movement. But what happens to Josiah? How? Where?
In battle, I think.
Where?
In Samaria.
Josiah dies at Megiddo. And in Revelation 16, we have the Battle of Armageddon. But this is the pattern. This is part of what helped me figure all this out. Is that's only the end of a certain age. And what we find out is that the apostasy of Manasseh was so bad that God was going to, no matter what good came out of Josiah's reign, no matter how much good Josiah did, he was still going to settle his accounts. And so God has, you can picture it, remember when God told Abraham that you can see all this land I'm going to give you, but you can't have it yet. And he said it's because the cup of the Amorites' iniquity was not yet full. So you can imagine each tribe, tongue, nation of people has a cup. And that as a nation gets more sinful and idolatrous, etc., God takes a grape and pinches the juice into it, and those are these are the cups of the wine of the fierceness of His wrath. So, because it got so bad, I mean, read of all the stuff that Manasseh did, and it's an exact pattern for the apostasy of the church. Then we have Megiddo, and that's when this age came to an end, but it's not the end of the age. So, the end of the age is actually the destruction of Jerusalem. And that was, following Megiddo, you had three sons of Josiah and a brother, and they're all worthless, basically. So, after the bowl is poured out in chapter 60, it says they did not repent. And what happened at Jerusalem? It was surrounded. The camp of the saints and the holy city is surrounded, you might say. But in this pattern here, Jerusalem gets destroyed. But in chapter 20, it's when the camp of the saints and the holy city is surrounded that fire comes down from heaven. So the pattern gets subverted there in Revelation 20, Gog and Magog. So that's really the entire story of Revelation from the founding of the church on through the end of time. And so the bowls start to be poured out. Here are the seven bowls of wrath. And every time you look in this chapter, Daniel 7 or Revelation, you'll see that the judgment is going to be upon those who dwell on the earth. We saw that in Revelations chapter 6 with the fifth seal. How long, O Lord, do you judge and avenge those who dwell on the earth? So this is definitely a temporal judgment. And I think that's what gets people so confused about what's being said here. There is a couple other things about the seventh bowl. One of them is verse 15. We have a quote from Jesus Christ. Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. That's Revelation 16, verse 15, the sixth bowl. So people see that and they think, oh, okay, so Christ is coming, so it must be the end of time judgments. But once Christ is given dominion here, He has the authority now to execute his vengeance on an earthly kingdom, and he's exercising earthly dominion. And that is what the seventh chapter of Daniel is communicating in part, that each of the previous four kingdoms were all earthly kingdoms. Christ begins as an earthly kingdom, and he's exercising dominion. Okay, so before the bowls of wrath, you had John receives his vision somewhere here, and so you had the six seals, and then you had the seven trumpets. Why did I say six seals? Seven seals, seven trumpets. And in my view, you have the question. Really, the question is this. So, let's turn to chapter 13 real quick.
Of Revelation.
Of Revelation, yes. Verse 1 of chapter 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous names. Then the beast which I saw was now the beast I saw, which was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. So you'll recall in Daniel 7, there are features of each of those kingdoms that are now a part of this beast. And then it says the dragon, who is Satan, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. The point I want to make here is that the beast rises fully formed out of this sea before the dragon gives him his throne, power, and great authority. So there's a lot to this, but I'm just going to tell you what I think we have is we have from 610 AD. And the reason is in Daniel, we read about those 10 horns. And then it said there was a little horn coming up after them. So he starts out little. And the kingdoms of Daniel 7, they were each consuming the kingdom that came in front of them. Well, the figure here is that each of them is giving each of these horns is giving this little horn its authority. So as each of them gives it its authority, it starts to get bigger and bigger. And the last kingdom to do it were the Lombards in 603. So that's where, and I place this in 610, because in 610 AD, he had gone out to create Islam, basically. That's the end of chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 17, it says, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went out to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus." So he went out to create Islam, and he comes back, and he sees this beast that's already been made because the kings have given their authority to it. And then he invests it with his power, and it's religious, essentially. And so the 1260 years is measured from then. And that's the time, times, and half a time. And in 1870, I can't remember his name, actually. I think it was Pope Pius the ninth, but I won't write that down. So Italy took over Rome. I believe that was in September of 1870. And the Pope was literally referred to himself as the prisoner in the Vatican, and he lost all diplomatic relations, and he actually refused to come out of his palace for 50 years almost, 1929, something like that. So those are the 1260 years. And this is the fifth, be somewhere along here, 1870. This is the fifth bowl of wrath. So if you want to turn to Revelation 16. Then the fifth angel, verse 10, then the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom became full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues because of the pain. So the throne of the beast, if you imagine the Catholic Europe as a map, and it looks like a city, then the throne of the city would have to be Rome. So that's the picture of the great city. So this would be somewhere in, I believe, be somewhere around here. 16. So that's the 1260 years. 610 is when Muhammad first started preaching Islam. So he has created that religion. And that is in the fifth trumpet. That's in the fifth trumpet. And then he comes back here in Revelation 13 and he gives his throne and power and authority to the beast. Between 493 and 603, all 10 of those kings, all 10 of those horns, they had either capitulated to Rome religiously or they had been subdued or plucked out. And those are the 10 horns in Daniel 7, three of whom were plucked out before him. So this is the basic theme, scheme of the entire book. And it's important to know, just as Megiddo was not the end of the world or that age, neither is it in the book of Revelation. That's why you get to chapter 16 and you still got a significant part of the book left yet to read. It's because the end of the world had not happened yet. So this is the 1260. And in Daniel 12, it mentions two other time periods. The 1290 and the 1335. So if you add 30, you get to 1900. And this is technically right as we're getting towards the seventh bowl. But then you add another 45 years, and that takes you to 1945. So this is the 1290, and this is the 1335. And these are from Daniel 12. You ought to see my notebooks at home. I've got three or four notebooks with garbage scribbled all over them like this. Now, what's going on, I think, is 1900, the reference that Daniel makes there is to the end of the millennium that he talks about in chapter 20. So the millennium, as I understand it, is related to Christ's dominion, but it's not actually Christ's dominion. If we look at chapter 20 of Revelation, we'll see it says, "Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. This is the first resurrection." It's those who had suffered the tribulation that are reigning with Christ. So in other words, this millennium is not only figurative, it's actually heavenly to begin with. And that's foreshadowed in chapter 7 of Revelation. In Revelation 7, 1 through 8, we have the sealing and we have the census of the tribes of Israel. And in verse 9, it says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number." And he goes on and talks about that, and they're singing out. He says, "All the angels stood around the throne," verse 11, "and the elders and the four living creatures, and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, Amen, blessed and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to God forever and ever. Amen. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, 'Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from?' I said to him, 'Sir, you know.' So he said to me, 'These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood. Therefore, they are before the throne of God.'" So they were under the altar at first, and now they're made alive, as it were, before the throne of God. So figuratively, they are in heaven. So the millennium itself is right at the end of the sixth trumpet in chapter 11. And it's when they were raised. And in at the end of the trial here in chapter 20. So that is the beginning of the 1,000 years of the reign of the dead saints, is the way I think of it.
So it coexists with the 1,000 years that Satan is bound?
Roughly, yeah. So that's what we're going to get to next, is when was Satan bound? Because in chapter 20, Satan was bound by the time the trial started. And in chapter 11, verse 1, we had the reed, which is also the trial. So one thing I noticed in the Old Testament is, and you have to look for patterns, the 70 years of the Babylonian Empire did not exactly coincide with the 70 years of captivity. So in 609 to 539 was the 70 years of the Babylonian Empire. But what was the captivity measured from? Well, there are actually several, weren't there? So you have this pattern where there's this slight skewing of the millennium. So we know that the trial began before the witnesses had even been killed completely, because that's in 11. So in chapter 10, we have this mighty angel coming down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was on his head. His face was like the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. He had a little book open in his hand, and he sat his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and cried with a loud voice as when a lion roars. Now, you would know, who would you normally associate all of this symbolism with? Jesus. So he's got a rainbow, so he's there to keep a promise. But all of these other things, his face like the sun, feet like pillars of fire, except this is not Jesus. It's an angel. Okay? Now, when a lion roars, he's fighting. He's about to conquer somebody. If you've ever seen a documentary, and I love lion documentaries, if you have a lion documentary on, I will sit down and watch it with you. But when lions go in to conquer a pride, they don't go in meekly. They roar the whole time. And there's a lot of biology to that, but what they're getting themselves to do is psyched up to go to battle, because that's literally what male lions do. So then it says, now, when he cried out, seven thunders uttered their voices. Now, when the seven thunders uttered their voices, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, seal up the things which the seven thunders uttered, and do not write them. Then the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised up his hand to heaven. Now we'll start there, but if you raise up your hand in heaven, you're indicating something. So what's going on here? Let's go to John chapter 12. This is an example of how close attention you have to pay to things Jesus said. So John 12, 27. Jesus says, now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. Therefore, the people who stood by and heard it said it had thundered. Others said, an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world is cast out. So what we have here is Satan being bound. So Satan was bound in chapter 20 before the trial. And note what he said. People hear something and they say it sounds like an angel, or it sounds like thunder. And here in verse 4, we have all those things coming together as well. And then Jesus said, now is the ruler of this world cast out. The difference here is Satan is not cast out. The difference is he's been bound and sealed. And that's part of the hidden language here. It says, seal up the things which the seven thunders uttered and do not write them. So we have that same word occurring here as in chapter 20, the beginning of chapter 20. And then he's telling them in verse 6, swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that are in it, the earth and the things that are in it, and the sea and the things that are in it, that there should be delay no longer. Basically, he's telling them to go ahead and start the trial. Verse 7 is key. But in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, the mystery of God would be finished as he declared to his servants and the prophets. Now, what happened in the days the seventh trumpet was about to sound is verse 13. In the same hour, there was a great earthquake and a tenth of the city fell in the earthquake. So this is God. The mystery is God making Christ's enemies his footstool.
I've lost you, Bible. Where are you?
Revelation 10. So in chapter 10, verse 7, but in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, the mystery of God would be finished. And that is the witnesses resurrecting, and then that begins the Protestant Reformation, where God makes Christ's enemies his footstool.
The little scroll
is essentially
the charges that are laid against the Antichrist. And that's why the story in the first part of chapter 11 begins, and it kind of covers the entire gamut. That's why it mentions the 1260 days. That story is more fully fleshed out in chapter 12 and 13. Now, if you look at the little book in chapter 10, verse 10. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Why does it say in chapter, verse 4?
What chapter?
Chapter?
Chapter 10.
Okay.
That seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered and write them not.
Okay. He's supposed to write down everything he sees. He's told that in the beginning of the book. But this is Satan. See, when lions fight, they roar. And Satan is also compared to a lion in 1 Peter 5:8. Satan walks about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. So that's the imagery that we're supposed to get, is Michael and Satan battling. But Satan is a mighty angel, and so he chains him up. And then he takes him down to the pit and seals him up. The reason he's probably not supposed to write down what Satan wrote is Satan is a blasphemer. And so he's probably blaspheming the whole time. And remember what Isaiah and Jesus said. When people are in hell, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So you can imagine that they're blaspheming the whole time. So there's nothing wholesome that comes from his mouth. The part of the seven is the fact that it's Rome. He's losing his headship of Rome. And Rome is the city set on seven hills, which is also from chapter 17. So kind of the way I picture this, and it actually does help to kind of imagine this as John would. Remember, John is seeing these things kind of like we would experience a movie. Is Michael is tasked with binding Satan. And so once he starts wrapping Satan up in his chains, he's kind of like, hey, what's the big idea? And then he throws him in the pit and seals him up. And that's like, so you can imagine Satan yelling something. And then all of a sudden the silence. Because once he is sealed, he has no influence or power whatsoever. Period. And that's why you see his two great empires start to crumble at the same time. In the book of Revelation, what are his two empires? Well, we've been talking about the Catholic Church and Catholic Europe. But what's the other one? Islam. They had as king over them the king of the bottomless pit. So both Islam and the Roman, the papal empire start to tumble at around the same time. And both of their falls are very slow and methodical, but inevitable as well. The corruption that set in the Turkish Empire was almost immediate after the time that they conquered Byzantium. So, when was Satan bound? Well, you have to keep going backward. But the beginning of the sixth trumpet, and remember, all this is happening within the sixth trumpet, is Revelation chapter 9, verse 13. And that is the taking of Constantinople by the Ottoman Turks. Now, think about that. If the two great empires under Satan's command at this time is Catholic Europe and the Turks. Once the Turks have conquered Constantinople, what is there standing in Satan's way at that point? Because he can almost literally do whatever he wants. So that's the perfect time to take away his headship. And I think that's when Michael seals up Satan. So that'd be it. Midway through the sixth trumpet, but no soon after 1453. And that's when Satan is bound. So it doesn't exactly coincide with the reign of the saints, but it's very close. But it does fit the principle that in order to strike the sheep, or in order to scatter the sheep, you must strike the shepherd first. And that's the other reason. Anytime you see a number like 100 or 1,000, it's an unspecified number that's perhaps close to the real number, but it's just saying, oh, for about 1,000 years. For about 1,000 years. And the other thing is, if you were born in 1453, and then the Reformation starts in 1517, well, that's roughly a lifetime. So you could say at the same hour. Like Jesus would say, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, or et cetera, et cetera.
Now, for one more complication, and then I'll stop for some questions. Who was Josiah trying to stop? Does anybody know who he was fighting at Megiddo? Egypt, Pharaoh Necho. In Ezekiel chapter 29 and 30, Egypt is called a dragon. Now, Egypt was always kind of thought of as a dragon because that's where the famous Nile crocodiles are, so it's a pretty easy association to make. But in the book of Revelation, Satan is called a dragon. And Egypt is twice called a dragon just in the book of Revelation. If you go to Revelation 16, in the sixth bowl, now recall that the fifth bowl was 1870. And it says, then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of what? The dragon. Out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet, for they are spirits of demons. So just as in the Old Testament, Josiah died trying to stop Egypt from coming up and saving the Assyrian Empire, so we have the dragon coming up right before the Battle of Megiddo, which is the seventh bowl. So the figures work, and I think that's an indication that Satan had already been released. And I believe that that's what the 1290 is about. So, again, 1000, the millennium, it doesn't have to actually equal 1000. It just means till the end of the age or the time is right. Roughly, it would last from 1453 to 1900. And for the saint, reign of the saints, it's actually 1517 to around the same time. And then the 1335 is the conclusion of the seventh bowl. Great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of the talent. Then it says, men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. So they did not repent again. They blasphemed God because of the hail. That's the destruction of World War I. And that's the seventh bowl. And from there, chapter 20 of Revelation indicates that Satan will not be bound again. He's going to be allowed to do his thing and deceive the nations until the Lord comes. But this is the point, and I think it may have just been poetic justice, that Satan is released in time to watch what Christ is going to do to his empires. Because the Euphrates drying up at the sixth bowl is a reference to the Ottoman Turks and how their empire literally just dried up. And eventually became the Turkish Republic that we all know and love. And then also to watch Europe just literally destroy itself. And there wasn't anything he can do to stop it, although I do think there are indications here that he tried to salvage it. That, in a nutshell, is the book of Revelation and the times involved there. But really, this when you look for patterns, when you find one that works, it can really start unlocking the various meanings of these things. I know that was a lot to throw at you, and I still have more that we could talk about. But are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Can you make a chart for us so that we can come to paper?
I actually am working on one.
Good.
It's been requested before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm making a mural, actually. And I'm going to use Dad and Cindy's garage, and we're going to open it up to the public and anyone that wants to come and see the bowls of wrath.
But I'm a person with visual.
And sure.
More of me than just throwing out numbers.
Right. There's a lot of schemes we could apply here. So, for instance, there's a whole other thread of Christ leading everyone through the wilderness, like Moses. Because we're told in chapter 13... Well, actually, at the end of chapter 12 of Revelation, if you want to look there. In chapter 12, verse 14, it says, the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness. Well, you remember in Exodus 19 and 4, God described their flight to him at Sinai as being mounted up on what? Eagle's wings. So every single thing that you see in this book and in Daniel has a meaning, almost all of which is taken from the Old Testament. Now, I've already read to you or alluded to you what the first indication that the church is in the wilderness. Because when you go to Revelation 7 and you read that there's these people
that are considered Jews in some respect, and they're sealed and numbered, and then you see the 12 tribes there, you're supposed to just say to yourself, oh, okay, I remember a story where the people of Israel went out from Egypt and they met God at Sinai, and what was one of the first things they did? They took a census. So this is your first indication that there's already, the church is already in the wilderness as of the sealing there. But that's not the only census. If we go to chapter 14, verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him the 144,000. So he's leading them out of the wilderness, just like Moses led the children of Israel out of the wilderness. So that's the second census, and right after that, he's going to watch God make his enemies his footstool. So that's a whole other thread that runs through the entire book. And that's why he's got his lamb hat on. That's why they keep referring to him as the lamb. He's the lamb. He's the lamb. So that's a whole other thread that you can look at as far as that goes. And it takes place during, it begins when the beast is given his authority. Because those two 1,260-year periods are concurrent with one another. Anything else? Yes?
I'm not sure I can say this right, but can you kind of... in the context of what you were talking about this morning, about how some people think about the Armageddon.
Okay.
That it's the future thing.
Okay.
How this changes all that. I mean,
okay.
This is
sure.
A really different view of that.
Well, this, I had my suspicions just based on the internal evidence of chapter 16 itself. But we have this pattern in the Old Testament that actually perfectly represents the entire age, up into including the end. And I noticed that on the way, Megiddo is just a waypoint. It's a necessary one, because in the Old Testament times, Josiah was such a good king, God had to get rid of him. And I know that's kind of harsh, but the time was right for Israel to, or for Judah to be punished. So he had to get rid of a good king. But it's just a waypoint to the destruction of Jerusalem. And in chapter 20 of Revelation, the holy city and the camp of the saints is surrounded, just like in 587 and 86. But the difference is, a remnant here was carried off to Babylon into captivity. In Revelation 20, a remnant is actually going to be translated into heaven at the end of time. But still, the pattern is pretty strong. And like I said, if you start looking at all of this stuff from Hezekiah and Isaiah's age, you'd be surprised at the level of detail you can get. Hezekiah's getting sick, and then Babylonians showing up, and then his life is extended for a time. And yeah, it can get pretty detailed. But the general scheme is accurate.
Yep. The battle of the Megiddo was the end for Jerusalem,
right,
for Israel.
Right.
The destruction of Jerusalem.
Right.
And so Armageddon is not the end of the Christian age.
Right.
It's just a prelude.
Yep. In fact, Megiddo, our Armageddon in chapter 16 is just the completion of the bowls of wrath, as is Megiddo, because he's putting an end to this as punishment for things done previously. And then at the end of the age, which I equate with the last judgment, the final judgment of Christ, that's when fire is going to come down. Now, we have in chapter 20, Gog and Magog surrounding the holy city and the camp of the saints. So I'm not going to say that that doesn't indicate that there's going to be some period of distress leading up to Christ's return. But when you read the language of the Great Tribulation that's described in chapter 7 of Revelation, chapter 12 of Daniel, there is no comparison. And numbers do matter. So I pointed this out to someone, I think, after our services. The Roman Empire is estimated to have killed about 12,000 to 15,000 Christians in its entire history. Now, one death is a tragedy, so I'm not trying to limp to say anything other than that. But numbers do matter. So we have 12 to 15K by the Romans, but we have 50 to 100 million during the roughly 500 to 600 years of the papacy. There is no comparison. So numbers do matter in that sense. And that is the Great Tribulation. And after the Reformation,
You'll notice the 1260 years hasn't ended yet. But what you see after the Reformation is a steady decline in everything the papacy does regarding imperium, the right to bear the sword. He's killing less people. The Inquisition start losing their steam, etc., etc. And it's quite simple. He's losing his swords. His house is being divided. His kingdom is being divided against itself. And so he's losing his swords. And he's got bigger things to deal with now than heretics. He's got major European powers like England and Denmark, Norway, and Poland to deal with now because he's losing their allegiance. So it's like, it's just like he had bigger problems. And so he was able to take his eye off the church, and that by itself was enough for us, for the church to start preaching again publicly and to feel emboldened to do so. The other thing I would point out along those lines is look at the description of the church that we read in chapter 11, verse 3. I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. And then he describes them as the two olive trees from Zechariah. And then he says, if anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner. They have power to shut heaven so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have power over waters to turn them to blood, to strike the earth with all plagues and often as often as they desire. So obviously he's using Old Testament prophets as a type of what is going on with these witnesses who are his church. From the days of Josiah, who was the major prophet, on past the destruction of Jerusalem. Anybody remember? Jeremiah. Jeremiah's father was Hilkiah, who was one of the priests who found the book of the law, if you recall that. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 1. Now, while we're turning there, what kind of life did Jeremiah live? It was very, very hard. Everybody hated him. That's because Jeremiah was preaching God's truth no matter who the audience. So if God had a message for someone, Jeremiah was going to deliver it. Now, in verse 9 of Jeremiah chapter 1, it says, then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you over the nations. I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. I have set you over the nations. This is reigning with Christ, in a sense. But it's not like we would tend to think, because all he's doing is he's taking the judgments. So if you continue to do this, God's going to do this. If you warn the wicked of his way, no matter what they're doing to you, then you're doing the Lord's work, and God could say, I have set you over the nations. So this is the power that he's given them there in Revelation 11. He's given them the power to persevere in face of all the hardships. So if you want to read about the Inquisition and all that was going on there, there was certainly horrible, horrible things going on. And yet, these our brothers and sisters from that time period, they just kept doing what the Lord told them to do, which is preach as the speak as the oracles of God. Anything else?
The part where I was mounted the dragon.
Yes.
The evil spirits. Are they doing their work today, in your opinion?
Yes. Absolutely.
And that, to me, might be more subtle,
right,
more dangerous,
insidious.
Than, you know, if you came up to me and said, deny Christ or die, I could easily say, I'm not going to.
Right.
But to be subverted and stuff. And I see this subliminal, this undercurrent, this in our schools, it's in our courts, it's in everything, and it's very subtle. It's, how could you be so mean to these people who are calling evil good and good evil?
Yeah.
But that's happening
every day.
In our news,
yeah,
in our television, in every media. And to me, that might be a better, bigger challenge to the church.
It is.
Than anything.
What did Peter say in 1 Peter, tribulation does? It makes us refined. When we're refined by fire, we come out shining like gold. The tendency, although it's sad, is that if we're not being persecuted, the church tends to get Complacent, yes. So someone asked me not too long ago why God would allow the Inquisition and all the millions of murders, and I said, well, God didn't. God punished him for that. But what God did allow, it does seem, is that he did allow the early stages of persecution, because persecution tended to be good for the church. It kept them chastened, and chastening is good for us. But where the abuses come also become obvious as the history plays out with the Roman Catholic Church and the growth of the Inquisition, then it just became over the top, is really all I can say about it. But yes, those three spirits as unclean frogs are still with us as I understand them. And I wish I had more time to go over that. But generally speaking, one thing about the dragon I wanted to point out. Because when you're looking in the Old Testament, you want to find patterns to all these things. And they sometimes help you understand what's being said. So in Numbers 21, the story of the bronze serpent, Nehushtan. So Numbers 21, verse 4. Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. So recall that the reason God sent these fiery serpents is that they were all complaining about the lack of food and etc. I think that Armageddon is a reference to the buildup of Germany in the 1930s. And does anybody know what was going on in Germany between World War I and the time the Nazis took over?
Oh, there was rampant inflation.
Which would cause shortages.
Shortages of everything.
Yep.
They said that you took your money to the grocery store in a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
And came home with food in a handbasket.
Right.
And there was political upheavals, multiple fanatical parties.
Right.
That were vying for...
And they were taking advantage of the desperation.
Desperation and the weakness of the government.
Yep. Yes, they were taking advantage of the weakness of the central government and the desperation of the people. And that's exactly what we see here. People complaining, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. That's exactly what was going on in Germany in the 1920s that the Nazis were able to take advantage of. This is the growth of, I believe, socialism, the welfare state, all these things. There's so many things that we could talk about and consider. But the conditions were taken advantage of by dark forces. People were desperate. They were longing for food. And Satan took advantage of that. Yes?
The three kings of the East in this period, are we talking like maybe Russia, Japan?
I did teach this at your house, and that was my opinion back then, but I think it's a little bit more local. So after the Ottoman Empire dried up in 1922, the Republic was declared in 23, and from that year on, they created the countries of Iraq, Kuwait, and for quite a long time alongside this period. Who else? Saudi, Jordan, Syria, all the modern states came out of the wake of the Ottoman Empire being dried up. For a time, they were controlled by Europe and France, but then shortly thereafter, they started setting up the states of the Middle East as we think of it today.
To end colonialism.
Yes. Right. Which is part of this beast. We have to remember that the empires that we associate with the European colonial powers all grew up at this same time as well. And so all those abuses that they committed are also included as well.
Churchill said he created Iran and Iraq with the stroke of a pen.
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there's a lot of things I like about Churchill, but there's a lot of arrogance there too. Along with that, does anybody know what the conditions of the Atlantic Charter were between Roosevelt and Churchill?
Well, they published the four freedoms. Freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom from hunger, freedom of worship.
And then they basically, in exchange for America's help, they had to make a commitment to decolonializing their empire. And if you look at Revelation chapter 18, I'm not going to go through this bit by bit, but it talks over and over again about merchants of the sea and the rich men and the mighty men in connection. Every ship, verse 17, every shipmaster, all who travel by ships, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea stood at a distance. This whole, the whole imperial period of Europe was created by navies and merchants. And so after World War II, all of the European powers give up their overseas colonies. That's a process. None of this stuff happens overnight. But that is part of the judgment of the seven bowls of wrath, as I understand it. Because when we look at Daniel, we have to keep in mind that the beast that he saw was the Roman beast even before it had the papacy. It was there was a beast there the whole time. And it doesn't actually come to an end until 1945, as I understand it. Anything else? This is a lot to swallow, I know.
So what does the beast look like today?
He looks like he does in chapter 17. So after the bowl's poured out, the angel says, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on the many waters." So the Bible makes it pretty clear that the beast is going to be there in some form, because in chapter 19 is when he actually tosses it into hell. And to me, that's just saying when he puts an end to all rule, power, and authority. But we see this harlot sitting on the beast, but she's not directing or guiding it. And the chapter 17 makes it very clear that the harlot is the great city of Rome. So it's the papacy. But she's just going along for the ride. She's not its head anymore. She's not directing it. And that's kind of like what I see the Pope as today, where he's just kind of a quaint old man and that people think is kind of cute. But 500 plus years ago, the popes were the deadliest men that have ever walked the earth.
They're still deceiving almost 2 million people.
Yeah, but out pretty much outside of Europe.
Right. Yeah. Without a sword.
Yeah. Good questions. Anything else? All right. Well, I hope I gave you plenty to chew on.
It's quite a bit for me, too.
So if there's anything that anyone wants to bring forward to the group at this time, we invite you to come forward as we stand.